Hey, it's great to be back. Wonderful. I don't know if you know me. My name is Brian. I actually work here. I'm what's called a pastor. And if you've been around for 6-7 weeks or so, you've never seen me because part of my annual rhythm is to try to get some fresh perspectives and kind of get away from a place that I really love. And I'm always concerned when I come back, everyone's going to realize, dude, we really didn't need you and we don't need you. Bye-bye. I'm always concerned about that, so it's wonderful to feel semi-welcome here today. A couple things we're going to do today. We're in the midst of a series on collision, and we're looking at how so often the physical realm represents things in the spiritual realm or mirrors things in the spiritual realm. One example is healing. You got a broken arm, or you have something, an open wound. There's a process that you have to go through to be healed physically. You don't have a broken arm, and so all of a sudden you drink something and boom, you're fine. Similarly, when we have spiritual wounds, when we have emotional wounds, there's a process that you go through. Very rarely does somebody have their hand, somebody's hand put on them in a prayer form, and instantaneously emotional and spiritual pain is gone, instantaneously healed. No, there is a process. There's a process that you go through. This is one of hundreds of examples we're trying to take a look at here in this series. And today what we're going to look at is the role of family. I know in here we have all kind of perspectives on family, all kind of different roles inside of family, whether you're single, single again, have kids, don't have kids, don't like kids, or you are a kid. No matter where you are, I'm thinking there's going to be something that's going to stimulate you and help you in the future. What we're going to do today is I'm going to bring up a friend of mine who is, I would now call him a friend. I would have called him a while ago, somebody who has instigated different thoughts in me. His name is Jeremy Pryor. And he's going to talk about what an ultimate family looks like. And wherever you are, you're going to have something, I think, that's going to help you go to a new place. Jeremy Pryor is his name, and Jeremy is an entrepreneur. He has started and run several businesses. One of the ones he runs right now is called Epifio, which is an internet-based business where they do videos for P&G, Google, Facebook, very, very innovative company. And yet, in the midst of this innovative life he lives, there's some core, solid, historic roots that he's been filtering into his life and his family, which have been very stimulating for me, and I hope so for you as well.
Howdy, Crossroads. My name's Jeremy. I've been hanging around here for about 3 years. And I've had a bunch of collisions, a whole series of collisions around this area of family where God's word and just his design has just collided with my life and the way that I was doing things in my family and the way I was thinking about family when I was single. And so I wanted to share three of those with you. As we dive into this, something I want to say just up front is that there are really a couple of different narratives or lifestyles that are described in the Bible that are quite different. One is the single lifestyle, and the way that that's described in the Bible is that single people have a gift, which is they get to live a simple and very wholeheartedly devoted life to the Lord. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 that when you're single, you get to be completely devoted to God with every part of you, and you can live a very simple life. And then when he goes on to talk about married people, he says, and you guys who have families are sort of stuck living a divided life. You've got a lot of stuff to work through. But the Bible also explains what's awesome about having a family is that we get to live a reproductive lifestyle, which sounds a little more fun than it really is, because it involves things like, you know, having to pay a mortgage or, you know, having to get lots of, you know, income or streams of income stabilized and doing things like education plans for the kids and just getting a home ready to have children that can then grow up and go out. And so these two lifestyles are different, but they work together in awesome ways. We're going to obviously dive kind of deep into the family one today, but we're also going to talk about how the single life interacts with that. But this collision, the first collision I want to describe to you guys that I had was around the value of family. And this happened to me when I was single, and I wrestled through that. And to understand the context of that collision for me, you have to know that I didn't grow up in Cincinnati. I grew up in a faraway land called Seattle, where families go to die. Seattle is not a place that loves family. They're on the cutting edge of all kinds of awesome things like technology and coffee and music and the cutting edge of the latest trend to totally devalue the family. And so I got caught up in that, and I saw that a lot. And in fact, I was taking my family back to Seattle. We go back every year, just a couple of months ago, and we were looking around for a campsite for our family. And we found a website that said family-friendly right there on the homepage. And we're like, yes, a family-friendly campground. That's cool, because last year we almost got kicked out of a campground for violating their two-child-only policy. So we got to this, we saw this campsite, and my wife picked up the phone and calls him up and says, you know, so I see on your website you say family-friendly. Can you just describe that a little bit? Tell me about that. And she said, oh yeah, we're really family-friendly. We have designated dog areas, we have a dog walk, and we even have a special dog bed laundry machine. And my wife was like, oh, that's kind of weird. Like, what about children? You know? Do you have anything for them? Oh, yeah. We allow children as long as they, you know, stay quiet after 10 p.m. We're like, man. So if my kids don't, you know. So we were trying to figure out, like, how do we do this family thing in this place? So Seattle is this, you know, one of the things they're also on the cutting edge for is they're actually the first city in the country where pet dogs outnumber children. Why is this happening? And, you know, we can look at that and go, whoa, look at those crazy people on the West Coast, you know. I knew we need to stay away from those people. But that culture is here in Cincinnati. And it's a culture that actually, I think, makes a lot of sense. It comes from the idea that, look, we're all living an individual life. We're trying to figure out what's best for us. And so does kids fit into that? And I didn't know the answer to that question. I kind of felt like, well, you know, kids should, you know, I could totally understand as a single guy, you know, as a Christian, the benefits of getting married, you know, those are really clear to me. But the idea of having children, that was a little bit like, you know, so I wasn't quite sure if you know, how that was going to work out. Maybe that would come with a package, but we'll see. And so that was the way I was thinking. And then I took a semester abroad in Jerusalem, and I was there for 4 months. And one day when I was just sitting in a public place, sitting on a park bench, minding my own business, this whole group of guys just, you know, walks past me and completely blew my mind about this idea of family. Because they were all together pushing strollers, you know, hanging out with babies with all their little toddlers in tow, having the greatest time. And I was like, what is that? I've never seen that before. Guys parading in public with babies? That's kind of weird. Because I've seen mommy brigades, you know, go by. But what I began to realize was in this culture, and I started looking around and I just started noticing that there's just a lot of dads hanging out with babies, a lot of dads loving children. They're just like explosive joy around this idea of having kids, having a lot of kids. And I was there to have a cross-cultural experience, you know, so I thought, hey, maybe I should get to know like what this is and why do the natives love, you know, especially the dads, love families so much. So I started asking them questions like, where did this culture come from? And the answer I got was, over and over again, the Bible. And I was like, that's weird, because the Jewish Bible is our Old Testament. In other words, it's a part of our Bible. So, I was in my fifth year of studying the Old Testament, both in undergraduate and graduate school. That's why I was in Jerusalem studying Hebrew. And so, but I didn't know what they were talking about. I'm like, what are you, you know, where is this in the Bible, in the Old Testament? So I decided to just, you know, dig in a little bit and try to figure out, you know, where this came from. And I came across, you know, kind of uncomfortable verses, like this one in Psalms. It says, children are a gift from the Lord. They are a reward from him. Children born to a young man are like arrows in a warrior's hand. How joyful is the man whose quiver is full of them. And that last line, how joyful is the man whose quiver is full of them, is kind of strange, because if I thought about a young guy with lots of kids, the word joyful is not the first adjective that comes to mind. I'm like, you know, exhausted is the man, or annoyed is the man, or trapped is the man, financially strapped, you know. So where does this idea, joyful is the man? And this is exactly what colliding is all about. When the Bible collides with what you believe, your lifestyle, then what a Christian does is they're like, maybe there's something that I don't understand. And so this collision was happening to me, and that obviously because I wasn't thinking, oh, joyful is the man, there's something different about the way I was thinking about kids and about family. So I started trying to figure out what that was. And I had a hard time until I ran across the story of a man named Abraham. And Abraham is a character in the book of Genesis, a really big character in the Bible. And he, I had studied Abraham, obviously, in the past, you know, as I studied the Old Testament. And he was always really a character that really showed how to live and walk by faith. This guy did some of the most took some of the most amazing steps of faith you can imagine. And so he was an example, and we always talked about him as an example of faith. But I had never thought about following Abraham's example as a father. And if you read his story, a huge part of it is his example as a father. And I did learn that these Jewish fathers saw Abraham as sort of their model for fathering. So what was different about Abraham's idea of family and his whole identity as a father? And basically, if you read about Abraham's life, he was constantly talking to God about his multi-generational family, his descendants, right? He would say, God, give me a son so that, you know, and God says, I'm going to, and you're going to be a great nation, Abraham. You know, and Abraham and God even talked about 400 years, what's going to happen in 400 years. And God said to Abraham, look up at the stars. Your descendants will be like the stars. Or look at the beach. Look at all the sand. Your descendants will be like the sand. And like, I was like, man, I don't remember ever praying, God, make me descendants like the sand, you know, like that was just not a goal I've ever heard of, except for in these ancient times. And so I was like, I realized, you know, my perspective on Abraham's idea of family was just, it's just plain primitive, right? It's from the past. It's archaic. It's ancient. And it doesn't really have any relevance to my life. And so, but I had to take a second look at that because all of a sudden I collided with a culture that actually viewed Abraham's idea of family as being relevant for today and this modern world. And so I began to try to figure out, well, what's the difference between the way Abraham thought about family and the way that, you know, I thought about it, or the way that pretty much every Western family I'd ever met had thought about it. So I drew a couple pictures because this could be a little bit, you know, complex to figure out the contrast. So in the Western world, the Western family really starts when a mom and a dad get together and they form a brand new family. And the way that we think about family in the West is every time mom and dad get together, a brand new family, we hit the reset button, every single generation, new family. And then they have some kids, and those kids, you know, the way the family is structured is, in a good Western family, is you want to create a really loving environment for the individual success of every single individual member of the family. So what we want to create in the West is a great springboard for the success of our children, who then, poof, leave the nest, go off and start their own family, and bink, hit the reset button again, next generation. Now, this kind of family has about an 80-year memory, which means that, you know, you usually, if you ask a typical Western person, you know, tell me about your great-grandparents, they can't give you a lot of stories. Or if you say, hey, name a few of your great-great-grandparents, that's going to be tough for a lot of us in the West. And that's just because we have this sort of reset button every generation. Now, the other way of viewing family, the other thing that's weird about the Western family, there went the dad. Where did he go? He disappears. And that's a problem. This is an epidemic in our culture, because dads just don't connect really well with Western families. It's sort of this nurturing nest, you know, idea of family. And so sometimes they're like, you know, nurturing dads are like, they're like, yeah, I really want to do that. I want to nurture some of the kids. But a lot of dads are like, hey, I want to build something. So there can be a lot of consternation where dads just don't ever really bond or identify with their family. And the statistics on this are staggering. I mean, they're getting as high as 70% of children live some or all of their childhood in a home separated from their biological father. That's a problem. And I was looking at these dads and kids and their view of family, and I had to stand back and ask the question, who's being primitive? Right? Have we really figured out a better way of doing family? Maybe not. So I'm taking a second look at this. So the other way of viewing family, the way Abraham would have thought of it, is the classical family. And we're calling it classical and not, you know, just biblical, because the Bible describes families this way, both in the Old and New Testament. But this is just the way that basically every major culture in the world thought about family until about 50 or 100 years ago, when we got so much prosperity in the West. And so the way that they would think is, hey, the world is a dangerous place. So the way that you start a family is it begins with a patriarch who casts a vision, who says, okay, this is what we're going to do to protect, provide for this family in this crazy, chaotic world. We're going to like buy this field. We're going to start this farm. We're going to pay off this house. We're going to start this business. So a patriarch steps up and says, this is what we're going to do. And they sort of get the family past the starting line and a little bit farther, and then pass the baton to the next generation. And so that keeps going generation to generation, and each generation just builds a little bit onto that. Now, I know sometimes when you hear the word patriarch, you might be saying, ooh. I mean, that word has been taking a beating in the last few decades. And the reason is, if you take the word patriarch and move it over to the Western idea of a family, what does that really mean? In a Western family, a patriarch can only mean that it's a family where we just do whatever really fits the selfish self-interest of dad, because it's just a one-generational family, and if he's being a patriarch, right, he's being patriarchal, that means he's just, I'm going to get everybody to sort of meet my needs. But in the classical family, the definition of patriarch is almost the opposite. The way Abraham would have thought of a patriarch would have been a guy who spends his entire life serving his family so that they can get to this point of multi-generational success. And so if you do this, you have a patriarch who casts a vision, passes it on to the next generation, it keeps growing, eventually what you have is a family legacy. And so, you know, there are families, right, in our culture that have a family legacy, even in the West, right? You might think about the Kennedy family. There was a patriarch in their family who said, we're going to get political power. And that was the vision that was cast. And so, bam, that's what they worked for. And there's like the Rockefeller family, we're going to start businesses and amass a lot of wealth and resources. So we have these kinds of families around. And one of the ethnic groups that really has been able to come to America and actually continue to live like a classical family almost more than any other has been Jewish families. They're less than 2% of the population in the United States. They have over 40% of the resources. The reason for that is really simple. If you sat down, you know, and you've done this maybe in your life or heard about this with a financial advisor, right? And they say, hey, I got a plan for you. If you save 10 bucks every day for the rest of your life, you'll have $1 million when you're 80 years old. And you're like, I don't need $1 million when I'm 80 years old. I need $1 million right now, you know? Like, I could use that money now. And so we have a really hard time doing that. But you tell one of these multi-generational patriarchs that they're going to have $1 million when they're 80 years old, they're like, sign me up. In fact, what's going to happen at 100 years, 150 years? Because I cannot wait to help the next generation set them up. So that's the reason why this happens, is because they have this multi-generational idea. And people that have this idea have about a 1,000-plus-year memory or history. And so, you know, for example, within Jewish families, they can actually trace their family line all the way back to Adam. You know, and one reason for that is their genealogy is right in the Bible, which is really convenient. But besides being convenient, it demonstrates that God actually cares about them knowing where their family came from and who they are and where their root structure is. And they get to do that and trace it all the way back. And so this is what we think of as a multi-generational family. And what really makes one of these families happen is this casting of a vision. How do you do that? How does that work in the West? How does it work as a Christian who doesn't care about political power? You know, we're not casting political visions necessarily or, you know, trying to amass great amounts of wealth. And so, you know, I heard a story that really helped me understand this recently in a book called A Million Miles in 1,000 Years by Donald Miller. And he's got a chapter in the book called How Jason Saved His Family. And the story goes, Donald was hanging out with Jason one day, and they were talking about life. And Donald says, what's going on with your family? What's going on with life? And he's like, man, it's not going well. You know, my wife and I just found pot in our 13-year-old daughter's room. And we're pretty sure that it came from this new boyfriend that she just got, who is completely using her. And so we've been trying to explain, you know, this to her, and she won't listen to us, and we don't know what to do. We're sort of trapped and stuck. And Miller says, man, it sounds like your daughter's caught in a really bad story. And Jason's like, what do you mean by that? He's like, I don't know. It just sounds like she's living out the life of a character in a bad story. Maybe she needs a better story. Well, Jason was like, weird. So he thought about that a lot, and then he started thinking, man, maybe I could give my family a different story. So he goes on the internet and starts looking around and finds an orphanage in Mexico that needs $25,000 or they're going to go under. And he writes to them and says, we're going to raise that $25,000. And he goes back and holds his family meeting, gets his wife and his daughter, they show up, and he's like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to raise $25,000 for this new orphanage. And they're both like, what? We got things going on. Like, you didn't consult with us. What are you talking about? Have you lost it? So they both left, you know, not interested. But for both of them, they started thinking about it. And they're like, they both came back to him during that week, both the wife and the daughter, and said, we're in. And the daughter was like, I've been thinking about how to do this, Dad. I mean, I'm going to talk to my friends. I'm going to start blogging about this. Can we take a trip to the orphanage? I want to meet them. And so they started planning their trip. And the next day, his daughter broke up with the boyfriend. So Donald hangs out with Jason the next week, and he's like, so what's going on? How are things going with your daughter? And Jason's like, man, it's changed, and told him the story about the orphanage and said, you know, my daughter is living a different story. She's a character in a different story. And it all really came down to the fact that he decided to cast a vision. Because the bottom line is, if your family does not find themselves in a great story, they will be captured by a lesser one. And there is no end to lesser stories that people are going to try to pitch to your family, you know, to try to exploit them for whatever reason. And so we have to stand up and cast a vision for our family. Why? How do we work together? Why would we work together as a family? And so that's just one example. So our family started thinking about things this way, you know, about 10 or 12 years ago. We started really, me and my wife started crafting a vision for our family, and it caused us to do a lot of things that were a little bit different. You know, we started some businesses, we started a ministry, we had a whole quiver full of kids, and we had, you know, we moved here to Cincinnati, and then my parents moved to Cincinnati and started partnering with us. My wife's parents moved here. My sister moved here. So extended family started coming, more cousins. We started working together. This was awesome. Our family started working together, building businesses, doing ministry stuff together. My dad just got back from Rwanda a few days ago, training pastors up there, 66 years old, and we helped fund him. So we started working together as a family and doing lots of cool stuff. But one of the things that happened when this happened was I began to realize, man, we're just heaping a lot of activity onto the family. And are we headed for burnout? Like, I don't just need a vision. I need a different way of doing family. I need like a different way of life. I need sort of a new paradigm or a new idea of how this works. I need new tools because the tools I've got are not going to help my family really sustain this kind of team effort. And so how do you build that family team? So the second collision was when I learned how to lead my family. And so I was looking for these tools. How do I do this? How do I become a leader of my family? Where are these tools at? And I didn't have to look far. And actually, a lot of you have probably had really good training when it comes to how to lead a family. Well, let me ask you this question. How many of you guys have ever like been a part of a team sport where you felt like you had a really good coach? Has anybody been well coached? So a lot of you guys have had that experience. That's an experience a lot of people here have had. And the same tools that a great coach uses to bring the team together are exactly the same tools that a head of household needs to really turn their family into a team. So this is, and I started looking at some tools like strategy. You know, great coaches take time to plan a strategy. Practice time. You know, great coaches run great drills and know how to run practices. Game time, great coaches know how to coach during the game and after the game. And then celebrations, great coaches know how to bring the team together and celebrate victory and really work through that. So those are just some tools. And so, you know, we don't really think about family that way. But just imagine if every father, you know, in America suddenly woke up tomorrow morning and when they saw their wife and their kids, they thought, oh, this is my team, and we got three practices and a game this weekend, right? What would they do differently? I mean, imagine the amount of involvement. Because, you know, let's face it, if a mom signs her son up for football this fall, she's just going to expect more personal involvement and even strategic involvement and interaction from that child's coach than her child's father. Why? Like, what happened there? And it's not because we're bad people as Western dads. It's because we're really confused about what we're doing. Dads are sort of like unemployed coaches that are looking for a team to join. And so we look around, we're like, oh, I need to find a team, you know, work. And so we find teams at work, and we love it, and we build camaraderie, and we build stuff together with other guys. And then we're like, sports. And then we go and we find teams in sports, you know, even church. We find teams to serve in and through at church. But we don't ever think and realize that the real team that God has given us is sitting at home, waiting on the bench for a coach to show up and engage, right? So that's the problem that we're facing. And so how do we get over that? We need these new tools. And so there's four things that I started to do that were different. And these four things I'm going to show you guys, there's nothing in the Bible that says, thus saith the Lord, you must do these four things. These are just tools that I tried to grab onto because the Western thing was just not working. And so I needed this new set of tools. So the first thing, how do I strategize through a family? So we began to do regular family meetings, just like Jason had to hold a family meeting for his family. This is something we do regularly in our family. You know, we got the whiteboards out, we got our like weekly rhythm and how we can involve the kids, we get them all involved in the meeting. We got our annual thing going, like our calendar, we plan for it in advance. We think about this stuff and we got it planned out. We do these kinds of meetings regularly. And a lot of times you're like, whiteboards in the home? I go home to get away from all that stuff. That's like work, that's business stuff, this is family stuff. Home is where I go to decompress, to relax, to veg out. But that's a big problem because you guys, whiteboards and calendars and stuff like this and strategy are not business things, they are vision things. When you set a vision, you need some tools to make sure that you can bring the team together and put it into action. And so we started doing these things as a part of our family. And it really helped us out a lot. A second tool that we learned from this world of coaching was with practices, we started using holy days. Now, holy days, of course, we call holidays. But holidays have become in our culture something that they really maybe never were supposed to be. There's things about holy days that really help fathers. And because I was looking for tools, right? And I go in the Old Testament, and I actually found the whole curriculum that God designed in the Old Testament and gave to fathers to train their children. I didn't even know it was there. And it was a series of five holidays or holy days. And so when I was in, and one example of this, when I was in Israel, I was there for the high holy days. And so one morning I just woke up and I'd never experienced anything like this before. I walked out of the youth hostel I was living in and there were these little huts in front of every house. And there was huge ones, you know, that were built out all of a sudden of every restaurant. And there was huge ones sticking out of the hotels. And it was like these huts everywhere. And I had no idea what just happened. It was like somebody just grabbed the county fair and just plopped it on my street, you know. And instead of us eating funnel cake and deep fried Twinkies, dads were like outside actually training their children. And I'm like, where did this come from? And this is a holiday in the Bible called Sukkot, or the Festival of Tabernacles. And this is a big part of the Old Testament. It's all throughout the Old Testament. It's in a lot of the first five books of the Old Testament. It's in the book of Nehemiah, it's Zechariah, it's even in the New Testament. The whole chapter, John 7, is when Jesus goes to Jerusalem to celebrate Sukkot. So this is a really big thing that I had never really understood before. And so what was this? Basically what Sukkot is that God knew that when the Israelites were traveling around in the wilderness, he said to them, you're living by faith right now, following this cloud, following this fire, getting manna, getting water from rocks, okay? This is a really cool experience. But what's going to happen is you're going to get the promised land. I'm going to give you a house you didn't build and a really sweet piece of fertile land, and the next generation of children are going to forget about me. You're going to forget that you walk by faith. So this is what I want you to do. Once a year, I want you to move out of your house, move your family out of your house, build a hut, live in it for a week, take your kids into that hut, turn around and point at your house and say, that is not our home. We are on a journey. We live by faith. And to help them not become materialistic. That, as a father, I was looking at that and saying, whoa, that would be useful in America, you know? That's a huge problem that we have. When you run into prosperity, you forget God. You forget that we're walking by faith. You forget what life's really about. And so I decided, hey, why not try to do this in our family? You know, I'm not trying to be Jewish. I'm just like, this is a really, really useful tool. So we started doing Sukkot about 6 years ago, and we started building these things in our backyard with our kids and started spending an entire week training our kids what it's like to walk by faith. You know, and we got lots of our friends together. There was even one year we had 50 people living in our backyard for a whole week, and we were just having a blast. So we've been doing this, and you guys, by the way, when we've done a bunch of other holidays that are just awesome training, it's just like practice time when you're in a sport. You know, really making sure that you're investing in each of those team members and as your team as a whole, these are really important things that you can give them. And so we were using holidays to do that. So coach, just one example. And the way that we did this, you guys, was really low key. The first year, we just did something really basic just for a couple of days just to try it out. And every year, we just sort of added layers onto it. And so it became really manageable for our family. The third thing that I looked at as a coach is game time. How do you do that? For our family, you know, game time really feels like when we go on mission trips, our family goes on mission trips to other countries and around the country every year. But you can do this right in Cincinnati. You can take your family and do game time right in Cincinnati. If you decide to go on mission just for a few hours, serve the city, and do it together as a family. And the way a coach would do this, right, is he would train his family, hey, this is what you're going to see, this is what you're going to experience. These are some things I want you to practice right here with each other. Then we're going to go out. We're going to be there. You're going to be there with your kids, coaching them, making sure that they understand what's going on. And then whatever happens, you come back and you just debrief. How did that feel? What was going on in your heart, you know, when you served that guy? Like, how did that feel? And you see, you're training your kids. This is one of the most amazing parts about training. You can't, how would you like to just practice and never actually play the game? It really creates the right synergy when you do both. And so that was one thing that we started adding to our family rhythm. And then the last thing, and probably the coolest thing we started doing, was the family meal, which is, you know, we eat dinner as a family a lot, but once a week, we just kind of pull out all the stops and do a really big family meal to usher in our day of rest and our day together as a family. And so that involves just cooking a big feast and having a big tablecloth, you know, where the father gets to be the father. I sit at the head of the table. And my wife really plays the role of mother. She lights the candle, begin the Sabbath. You know, my son is a son. Our daughters get to be daughters. And we bless our kids. We have this awesome feast. You know, we put our hands on our daughters and son, and we bless them. Like when I bless my son, I just say, you know, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. May he give you the heart of David, the faith of Abraham, and the righteousness of Christ as you build our family from generation to generation. And as our parents started moving here, they started getting involved in our family meal. And so my parents come a lot, my wife's parents come, and they bless our kids. And then afterwards, we go into the living room and just tell family stories, just to make sure our kids understand where they came from. These are who your ancestors are. These are, you know, God is telling a story. You're a part of something big. You're going to be handed a baton someday, you know, which is the reins of this family, and it has a history, and God is telling a story through this family. And all of that happens because we have this really dynamic family meal. And again, this is something we took tiny baby steps in, and over the course of a number of years, we really started to refine over time. But those are just some tools that really gave, you know, people say to dads, lead your family. You know, I'm like, how? Like, give me something. And so I just wanted to give you guys a few tools that we use, because they're really practical stuff on just how to start this. And then the third thing that I learned was how to serve through the family instead of like serving just as individuals. You know, we do everything as individuals in our culture, just about. You know, we work as individuals, we play as individuals, with our kids, they are in different sports teams, they do so much stuff. We do ministry in different directions, we do so many things. And so to serve through the family was a new idea. And I actually found most of the resources from this from the New Testament. There's actually a lot in the New Testament about how families can serve God together as a team. And in the Bible, you know, if you just start reading the Bible, and especially the New Testament, when the church started, you start to just discover this constant theme, which is, you know, they met in homes. It keeps saying that over and over again. And I was always confused about what that was. Like, what do you mean you met in homes? Did you just sort of take what we've got right here at Crossroads and just jam it into a living room somewhere, you know, and just do the same thing and just, but what was going on? And what I didn't realize was that what was happening was these were first century Jewish families. And first century Jewish families lived out their entire spiritual life through the home. They would worship with the family. They would do all these holidays, five a year, with the family. So the father and mother, the whole spiritual life happened inside of a home. And so in the Bible, there's a word for this kind of family, and it's used constantly in the New Testament. It's the word oikos. That's the Greek word. And it's translated in English just household. And so these oikoses, these households, were the primary sort of small unit of the church in the first century world. And these oikoses had a really important, significant responsibility. The first thing that they would often do is they would partner with single people. There was a real dynamic partnership in the first century between singles and between families. If you want to read a lot about that, there's a chapter in Luke chapter 10. Jesus talks specifically about this partnership. Jesus had primarily single people that were following him around. He has 72 disciples at this time in his ministry. And what Jesus decides to do is break them into groups of two, and he told them, hey, this is what I want you to do. Go to all these villages that we're about to head to. Go to the different cities and find one family. The two of you move in to one family home. And when you get there, this is called the sort of a family of peace. Get there, go into that home, you know, and just eat what they give you, stay there, and begin to partner with them to bring the kingdom to that whole village. And so that partnership was really dynamic in the first century because singles had all this energy. They had the ability to really spread the gospel from city to city, but families had a different set of tools. They were rooted in the city, and they stayed in the city, and they built families in the city, and so they could transform their village or their city if they did this partnership with the singles. And so that's the way that Jesus told them to go. Paul did the exact same strategy. There's over 20 different households that are listed, or oikoses, in the New Testament that Paul used in different cities all throughout the Roman world that he worked through. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that these families adopted spiritual orphans. So there's this kind of term in the Bible, or this idea that we have in the church here, which is just discipleship, which just means growing up into maturity. And in the first century, this primarily happened in the family. God intended for us to experience growth in and through the family structure. Why is that? Because God himself is a father. He wants to father us. He wants to show us, he wants to give us fathering love. And I know, you know, a lot of people, we've had hard experiences with that in our own life. But we can't avoid the fact that God is a father, and he wants us to experience his perfect fathering love. How are you going to experience that in a program? You can't. And so you need to experience that through the family. And so what happened is, when a brand new person became a Christian, they were actually adopted as sort of a part of this household. And so this household had all of its rhythms going on, things they would do every week to worship the Lord or to experience and train their own children. And the new believers would just sort of come right along inside of that. And the way that ultimately completely transformed their cities was that it would raise up these spiritual orphans, and they would end up spreading throughout the city until one family had many, many, many generations of spiritual children in the city. The third thing that happened a lot, and this is a historical fact, is that this first church, the early church, these oikoses, would adopt lots of physical orphans. Because, you know, in the first century, orphans, there's a huge problem of infanticide in the Roman world, because they just didn't have a lot of value for human life. And so if a family didn't want a child, they'd just leave it outside until it died of exposure. Well, what would happen is that the moms and dads of these oikoses would just be walking down the street, and they would see these little babies, and they would identify completely with that baby, because they would say, "That's my story. I was an orphan. I rejected my family, and then my father came and rescued me and adopted me back into the family." And so they would see this orphan and say, and they would, that would give them the energy and the vision to take that orphan in and adopt them into their own family and raise them as their own. And this is something that God is initiating all throughout America right now. Families are catching the vision to adopt orphans, because it's a central part of our own story. And the fourth thing that happened is that eventually, when a mother and a father built one of these oikoses over many decades, they would adopt the whole city. They would say, "I want to serve the city. Instead of retiring, I want to stay here because my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren are going to be here. All of my spiritual children are here in the city. So I want to become a city father." And the Bible calls that an elder. And that's a really important role in the first century, where they would begin to serve the entire city spiritually. So that was the vision. Those are some of the collisions that happened to me. And I know that a couple of things can happen when you hear a lot of this stuff. One is, ooh, man, you know, I look at my family. I don't think, you know, you talk about like your parents coming over for this meal. I would want my parents to come over. You know, they wouldn't be a real blessing to my children. That's just reality. Now, the cool thing that you should really remember is that Abraham had exactly the same problem. Abraham had to start over. The Bible says that his father, Terah, was an idol worshiper, and he made idols for a living. And so Abraham actually had to become separate from his family and start a new family line. And there are a lot of people here who God is calling to be the Abraham and Sarah of your multi-generational family. Don't be discouraged by that. Your family needs you to go ahead and step out and begin to build this family. The other reaction I know that can happen, and I talked to a friend of mine about this, that said, you know, she had a really strong family, but in her past, she had been divorced, her husband had been divorced, they had a blended family, they had a shared parenting situation, yet they were building a really strong family. And so I asked her, "Wow, how did you do that? How did you overcome all those obstacles or the discouragement that can come from that?" And she said, "Jeremy, I had to remember, and God gave me this three words that just helped me get through, and it was start from here." It does not do good to get discouraged about the failures or the obstacles that have created by the past. Your children and your family in the future need you to start from here and begin to build into the future. Remember, this is a multi-generational project. You don't have to get it all right in your generation. Our job as parents now is do our best to give our kids a leg up and point them in the right direction.
Thank you. Amazing. Awesome. Just a few comments and some banter back and forth. It's interesting. I was sitting there, and you weren't as cognizant of using inclusive language as much as you had in other services. You focus a lot, dad, mom, and in other services you talked a lot of, or talked about dad and father, almost exclusively this service. Other services, you made more allowance for, obviously, women are leaders in the home, single moms, all that kind of stuff. And so initially I was kind of sitting there thinking, oh gosh, he's got to start kind of using more of that language. And I thought, no, this is probably really good for this crowd, because any crowd, really, because we at Crossroads really like to focus on men, and this message of family is not given anywhere. We devalue family entirely in our culture, or we exalt the kind of family that doesn't work and doesn't sustain itself, and specifically men. We never have the role of dad being played up as a sexy, incredible, team-oriented role. Yeah. In fact, I would admit, how many of us feel like poop right now? Who feels like poop in here? I do. I feel like poop. I feel like poop. I don't right now, but when Jeremy first started introducing me to these things, I'm going, I'm a loser. I'm not doing tabernacles. I'm not setting up tents. I'm not lighting a candle. I'm a loser. I'm a total loser. And I went from that to realizing that's this form of condemnation that is not from God. Book of Romans says there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ. So if you're forgiven by Jesus and you're feeling, you know, difficult here, it could be conviction, but it's never condemnation from God. It is not. There could be a new frontier that you have right now. And I got over that kind of feeling like a butthead to, hey, I got a new frontier here. And I'm ashamed to admit that some of my best leadership has gone to Crossroads. I came to that realization, My most creativity has been focused towards Crossroads. And I start saying, what would it be like to give more creativity to my family, more leadership mojo to my family? And Crossroads will always get more than sufficient leadership and creativity for me, always will. But I started to think through, what does that look like? And I started getting excited and started to do some things differently because our family is about Cincinnati. It's kind of our vision. I've got two kids that are going to be in UC. In a couple weeks here, and it's kind of a good thing because number one, it's about the cheapest college education going, and it's not cheap enough, number one. Two is, I love that our family is putting down roots in Cincinnati. I love that. One of our kids could have gone anywhere they wanted around the country, but it's kind of a Cincinnati thing because we want to be a blessing to the city. That's part of what you talked about there.
Yeah, so I think what Brian's expressing is the heart of that city father. He cares. He wants to adopt the city of Cincinnati, and he wants to cast that vision for the whole Tome family, which is awesome. That is what transforms cities, guys, is when families take seriously that responsibility. Instead of sort of using the city, we adopt the city, we love the city. We realize that if you know, Brian's realizing, if my kids are going to grow up here, my grandkids are going to grow up here, my great-grandkids are going to grow up here, I better start to really do some practical things to help bless and transform this city.
This vision you have, for me, is invigorating. I mean, most of us, if we're parents, we have kids, or if you are a kid right now, the default vision for kids is this. Don't do weed, or at least not too much weed that you have to go to rehab. go to college so you can get a good job, and then leave me alone and let me retire. That's kind of the vision. That's, you know what, that's not a captivating story. That's not a cap. That's why we have perpetual adolescence. Talk about adolescence and the guy who came up last night.
Oh yeah, so there. You know, think about where do kids get their identity? I mean, around 13 years old, almost every child starts to ask an incredibly deep question: who am I? And what we do in our culture is say, I don't know, honey, you can be whatever you want to be. Like, go find yourself. You know, we don't want to limit you. And so what happens is kids start to wander around looking for who they are, and they test this and they try that, and it goes on and on. It starts at 13 and goes until 20, 30, whatever. You know, and a guy came up to me last night and said, please pray for me. I'm a 45-year-old adolescent. I need prayer. And I totally understand that feeling, because we don't have a way of giving our kids that identity. And sort of a contrast to that, in Jewish families, for example, adolescence happens in about a 3-hour event called a bar mitzvah. You know, what they do is they have a six-month thing, and at 13, you get your grandfather, your father, the uncles, all these people come around, all these family members. They fly in if they're from other cities. They say to the son, this is who you are. This is where our family came from. And what that does is it gives children roots. It gives them an identity. And we think, again, in our culture, well, we don't want to limit our kids. That doesn't limit kids to get to understand who they are, where they came from, and who their family is. It gives them deep roots, and the trees with the deepest roots grow the highest. And so we need to really begin to think about how do we really help our kids to not have to go on an endless search for identity, but help them understand they can find that identity in Christ, and they need to find a certain amount of that rootedness of their identity in their family as well.
And this is where the collision comes from. The idea of family comes from God. God exists in community, if you will, in a triune family, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. The church is likened to and called a family, and all of us are looking for families. We'll find it one way or another. It just won't be a meaningful and satisfying one if it's a family that's vision is around partying. It's a family, its vision is around self-actualization. If it's a family and gathering people around us who are all about second homes, and that's really our vision, or if our vision is, I mean, we go on and on, we're all looking for this. This is a vision that God gives us that can ultimately satisfy, change our world, and actually give us meaning, and way to bring it to us today. Awesomeness. Let's thank Jeremy. Awesome. Why don't we stand right now? I want to pray for all the different sectors that we have represented, and I want us to be able to close this out with a prayer and a final admonition. And let me just pray for you. God, I am praying right now for those of us who are single, or single and we feel less than, and we are not. We are not. There is a level of freedom, a level of ability that uniquely exists in the single situation. And I pray that you help us to hold on to that and to find a family structure to be a part of, whatever that looks like. I pray for those of us who are single again, thought we were on a good path, thought we were going the right way, and all of a sudden, life dealt us a joker. We have no idea where to go from now. We are in disequilibrium. I pray that you would bring peace and an awareness of a future. Pray for those of us in here who are in families and don't have kids and want kids. I pray that you would give us hope and give us the ability not to look at children as our God, but as you as our God. I pray for those of us in here who have relatively healthy Western families, that you are now giving us a new place, a grander vision to go after. You would give us the tools and the endurance to chart a new course. I pray for those of us in here who are children, you'd help us to recapture or capture for the very first time the beautiful thing that a mom can be, that a dad can be. God, in the midst of all of our places, we are broken. We are rarely fulfilled, and there are new places to go, and we want to reflect on these words and say these words to you.